This is January 27th, 2013, and today I'm going to talk about simplicity, the simple life. I had planned to talk about something else, but I discovered 20 minutes ago that all my notes and preparation I had left at home. So this is one that I have been meaning to do for quite a while. And I know that this is preaching to the choir to a lot of you who are hearing this. A lot of people long ago came to recognize the value of a simple life. In fact, perhaps many of you, like me, came to the conclusion that the simple life begins with simplifying the mind. That's really what it comes down to. Everything comes out of that, a simplified mind, and that, of course, is what Zen practice offers us, a way to simplify the mind, strip it down to the essentials, get rid of the clutter, the excess, so that we can get clear about the essentials, what's important. I'm going to begin, though, but by reading from an article I've had for years. Unfortunately, I don't know what magazine this is from. I cut it out years ago. But the name of the article is The Simple Life by David E. Shi, S-H-I, David E. Shi. He's a president of Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina, and he's the author of a book called The Simple Life, Plain Living and High Thinking in American Culture. I've always thought of reading this article and commenting on it in the winter when our lives do become simplified. I mean, just by necessity, at least in this part of the country, this latitude, where it's so little to do outside, unless you're a great winter sports person. But I'm just going to hit a few highlights from this article. The simple life is almost as difficult to define as it is to practice, for it's not so much a single idea as it is an omnibus label encompassing an array of ideals and activities. These include a concern for family nurture and community cohesion, hostility toward luxury and a suspicion of riches, a belief that the primary reward of work should be well-being rather than money, a desire for personal self-reliance and creative leisure, a nostalgia for the supposed simplicities of the past, and an anxiety about the technological and bureaucratic complexities of the present and future, an aesthetic taste for the plain and functional, especially in the home environment, a reverence for nature and a preference for country living, and a sense of both religious and ecological responsibility for the proper use of the world's resources. Some of these he's not necessarily subscribing to. You know, for example, his reference to a nostalgia for the supposed simplicities of the past. But I think he outlines most of the different ways that we have of thinking about simplicity. He quotes Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau, as saying, "Simplify your life. Do not devote your life to non-essentials or the acquisition of unnecessary possessions. Avoid clutter." I also thought that doing this Taisho during the term intensive would be some good timing, because For some people, that's what one of the pledges they make in their term intensive is to clear things, reduce clutter, get rid of things. He goes through a lot of history of thought about simplicity way back to the Stoics, Cicero, Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. But I'm going to forego that and skip all the way up to the third page where he says, today simplicity remains what it has always been, an animating vision of moral purpose that seizes and nourishes ethically sensitive imaginations. It offers people a way to recover personal autonomy and transcendent purposes by stripping away faulty desires and extraneous activities and possessions. For simplicity to experience continued vitality, its advocates must learn from the mistakes of the past. Proponents of simplicity have often been naively sentimental about the quality of life in olden times, narrowly anti-urban in outlook, and disdainful of the liberating and enlightening effects of prosperity and technology. After all, most of the high thinking of this century has been facilitated by prosperity. High thinking is in quotes. It's a reference to words by William Wordsworth, who referred to plain living and high thinking. But anyway, this most of the high thinking of this century has been facilitated by prosperity. Yeah, we must never lose sight of that those of us who live in a relatively affluent society and as individuals relatively comfortable, at least, at the very least, relatively comfortable middle class lives, because of that moderate comfort, have the freedom, the opportunity to aspire to something beyond just our base needs, shelter, food, so forth. The expansion of universities and libraries, the democratization of the fine arts, and the ever-widening impact of philanthropic organizations, all of these developments have been supported by the rising pool of national wealth. This is no mean achievement. And then he quotes Emerson saying, a creative economy can be the fuel of magnificence. So let us acknowledge how fortunate we are. And at the same time, never losing sight of how many do not share our good fortune, how many, even in this our own city here, much less other parts of the country and other parts of the world, don't have the luxury of taking time every day to turn the mind inward. He says, happily, modern simplicity demands neither an end to national economic growth nor a vow of personal poverty. If the decision to lead a simple life is fundamentally a personal matter, then so too is the nature and degree of simplification. There is no cosmic guidebook or universal formula to follow. Although some prominent enthusiasts have verged on asceticism, they have been the exception rather than the rule. Simplicity in its essence demands neither a vow of poverty nor a life of rural homesteading. Money or possessions or activities in themselves do not corrupt simplicity, But the love of money, the craving of possessions, the lure of conformity, and the prison of activities do. The prison of activities. How many people have told me in Doksan and outside Doksan of how boxed in they feel by the busyness of their lives. Well, I recently gave a teisho on that whole matter of busyness. But it's really something to reflect on how we can corner ourselves with all of the things that we feel obliged to do. One of which is the email. So many people talk about how overwhelmed they feel by email and its demands. But there is an element of choice in this, isn't there? But this is basic Zen understanding, is it's not about the so-called, it's not about the circumstances or the conditions of our life so much as it is about what we bring to those, how we use or misuse the mind. It's about our degree of attachment, either our degree of attachment to our activities and our things, our possessions and our money and so forth, as well as our attachment to the notion that we have to renounce everything in order to reap the benefits of simplicity. Same with choices. We start off the affirming faith in mind with the great ways not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. There too, it's not that we have to give up preferences. How could we do that? We all have preferences in taste, in food, in color, in style, and everything else. No, we just have to give up our attachment to our preferences. That's where the problem lies. And it's not a moral issue. It's just for our own peace of mind, it will serve us to not be attached to our likes and dislikes. That's all. It's just a matter of reducing our suffering, our frustration. So many great thinkers, wise men and women of the past who figured this out a long, long time ago. Oscar Wilde, simple pleasures are the last refuge of the complex. Kant, Immanuel Kant, one is not rich by what one owns, but more by what one is able to do without, with dignity. Even the American theatrical agent William Morris, simplicity of life, even the barest, is not misery, but the very foundation of refinement. Someone gave me an article from the New York Times about a great designer by the name of David Milinarek, who became England's foremost decorator of period interiors with grand-scale commissions to refurbish the National Gallery and the Victoria and Albert Museum. He's also decorated a Tuscan villa and an Umbrian castle, as well as homes for Mick Jagger, Eric Clapton, and Lord Rothschild. And the author he's the one who visited when he was 21 years old. He visited the apartment of Billy Baldwin, who was a commanding figure in American decorating. But he had a surprisingly modest apartment with glossy brown walls set off by white moldings. And then this Milinarek said, "I've thought a lot about that apartment since then. I remember thinking that it was so small, and yet it had everything he could possibly need." And this Miss David Milinarek tells us what we know. Often the simplest things are easiest to like. In clothes, food, gardens and landscape, as well as in buildings. As well as in people. This is the fruit of long meditation, long years of meditation, is a simplicity, a transparency in a person that is so appealing. It happens even without meditation. It happens as we age. We all must know older people who we recognize, in whom we recognize that simplicity, that refinement. It is a refinement. But back to our article by David Shi. As an ethic of self-conscious material moderation, rather than radical renunciation, simplicity can be practiced in cities and suburbs, townhouses and condominiums. It requires neither a log cabin nor a hair shirt, but a deliberate ordering of priorities so as to distinguish between the necessary and superfluous, the useful and wasteful, the beautiful and vulgar. William James, the philosopher, once remarked that wisdom is knowing what to overlook. This is a lesson that parents and teachers have to learn in guiding their children or students. What to overlook. Indeed, the key to mastering the fine art of simple living is discovering the difference between personal trappings and personal traps. In this sense, simplicity is ultimately a state of mind, a well-ordered inner harmony among the material, sensual, and ideal, rather than a particular standard of living. He ends the article by saying, those who choose an outwardly more simple and inwardly more fulfilling style of living discover that pressures are reduced, the frenetic pace of life is slowed, and daily epiphanies are better appreciated. Simpler living also benefits us all by reducing demands on our increasingly fragile and besieged environment. In addition, winnowing one's money-making and money-spending activities can provide more opportunities for activities of intrinsic worth, family, faith, civic and social service, aesthetic creativity, and self-culture. The saintly naturalist John Burroughs acknowledged this fact in 1911 when the superintendent of the New York City schools asked him to share with students the secret of his good life. With me, he remarked, the secret of my youth, at age 74, is the simple life. Simple food, sound sleep, the open air, daily work, kind thoughts, love of nature, and joy and contentment in the world in which I live. I have had a happy life. May you all do the same. I suppose this kind of advice can sound rather naive or childish to some people, but we discover through Zen practice that what he says is true. Simple food, sound sleep, daily work, kind thoughts, love of nature. I always find that when I get out in the winter, when I get outside, take a walk, especially in the woods, that the whole character of my experience of winter changes, becomes so much more interesting and acceptable in a way. Because when we get out in it, then we are it. We are literally one with it. And it's winter, the topic of winter that I'm going to turn to now. Winter as a metaphor for simplifying and actually a more Spartan, a more simple style of living. This is a wonderful article, and somehow I don't have the author in this. I had meant to Google it before coming in to the Zendo this morning, but didn't get a chance. But it's still wonderful, even though we don't know who wrote it right now. It's called A Fire Inside, Thoughts on the Creativity of Winter. Outside my window, the wintry English fields spread, as they have for centuries, to the dark, smoke-blue line of woods that limit the horizon of the valley. A bright fire burns in the grate to my left, while outside I can hear the call of a barn owl cutting the still, even air. All is exactly as it has been for many a hundred year in these Cotswold hills where I happily find myself this winter's day. Everything from horizon to horizon is eternal and quiet and seemingly unchangeable, except that is, for one tiny but extraordinary portal I can open on this laptop to a parallel world of web-borne news, a world supposedly more real than the quiet one I inhabit this cold but beautiful evening. With a few clicks, I can enter an astonishing world of worry, anxiety, and for many individuals, and indeed whole societies, material hardship, brought on by the cessation of credit. I think this was written, sounds like it was written at least 2 years ago, when sometime after the recession hit. Out of the hermetic silence of a quiet winter day, I can take a few short steps and almost touch the sense of panic and the extraordinary breakdown in trust that has stopped the flow of currency from one person to another, one bank to another, one society to another. It's as if the cold hands of this financial season have touched every last monetary stream and rivulet and frozen them over. It is winter here in the countryside with all its well-loved beauties, but out in the world of money, it is winter with another form of terrible beauty, the winter of disappearance, immobility, and the worry, fret, and anxiety that comes from seeming to have very little shelter from its effects. It is always a trauma for the human psyche when those elements it has over-invested itself in at the periphery of life are withdrawn and the spring-like world of growth and opportunity seems to close down, as if the old currencies have become worthless while we as yet do not know how to value or harvest the following season. But this form of trauma has also been seen by many of our great religious, contemplative, and artistic traditions as an invitation back to another kind of valuation, a return to a more internal focus, an opportunity to revive an old friendship with the place from which all the peripheries are recognized, priced, and named. The place from which all the peripheries are recognized, priced, and named. Of course, he's talking about the root, getting back to the root. In Zen, the root is this realm of no mind, out of which all activities, all functions of the mind and the body-mind, arise. It's withdrawing to the simple core of our being. He continues, this internal, alchemical, almost catalytic core of identity-making and decision-making has long been associated with the soul of an individual, the part of us attempting to belong to the world in the biggest way it can, the part that witnesses our outer actions, stirs our conscience, and quite often seems to be at odds with those other parts of us trying to game the system at the periphery. It is interesting to think that what may be a financial trauma for the surface personality may be a break for freedom for a more serious central core of the psyche, the part that understands its own mortality and secretly knows that it will eventually all come to a place where we have to give up on all the peripherals anyway, at that unknown, appointed crossroads when our particular individual life as we know it comes to an end. I think just as this he's using winter as a metaphor for withdrawing into our essential being and getting free of attachments, to use a Buddhist word. We can do every day when we cross our legs and do zazen. And it becomes more intense, of course, in sesshin. Sesshin is a withdrawal. It's a withdrawal and a renewal where we acquire a new perspective on this life as we know it, where we get reacquainted with the root of things, which arguably only happens when we don't have the option of continuing to feed this acquisitive, grasping mind. He continues, in times of difficulty, it is tempting to think that creativity, vision, and new possibilities must be put aside simply in order to survive. It is tempting when the financial tide goes out to act from a sense of impoverishment. It's easy to feel abandoned when the source and sense of our riches are no longer in the summer air, but hidden deep in a form of winter potentiality. It is always very hard to understand that the world has shifted to another axis of generosity, one not so readily recognized, When we feel bereft of one form of support, we can easily forget that it is because we might be meant to put that particular form of comfort aside and look to a fiercer, more internally grounded stage of our maturity, one that might emanate from a simpler but surer ground than the outer sky of mirrors and monetary instruments we might have constructed for ourselves in the so-called real world. Yeah, this is the experience of sesshin, of extended sitting, or even not extended, but deep sitting. To put that particular form of comfort aside and look to a fiercer, more internally grounded stage of our maturity. One that might emanate from a simpler but surer ground than the outer sky of mirrors and monetary instruments. It also might be surprising to think that there are just as many forms of courage and creativity associated with disappearance and doing without, just as many satisfying elements of aliveness associated with a winter as with spring. This central core conversation to which we return in each succeeding winter is both nourishing and deeply disturbing. It seems heedless of any flimsy structures we may have erected. It seems fiery in that it burns familiar things away and yet provides another form of warmth emanating from a more nested interior hearth. In my experience, the first necessity of an individual in finding this fiery core conversation is a radical form of simplification. To get to the core conversation, we have to withdraw from the edges. Whatever expenses we've been making at the margins of our lives in terms of emotions, finances, or time-based commitment must be brought back to the central conversation that makes the most sense. Radical simplification often entails a seemingly ruthless withdrawal from secondary involvements. It also involves simplifying wants and needs to grant us another form of freedom, not necessarily involved with the freedom to buy anything we want at any time. Arguments for indiscriminate buying to revive the economy are circular and lock human beings into a never-ending cycle of buying goods that are non-essential, with everyone encouraged to live beyond their means, to the ultimate dismantling of the natural systems that supply those wants in the first place. The practice of radical simplification, however, might not mean living in a desireless, enlightened state, but simply catching our desires as close to the center of our experience as possible. We'll get back to that, but I just wanted to pick up on a couple things here. He mentions twice in this paragraph this core conversation, and the central conversation. But why stop there? Why bring conversation into it? Go even further into what is beyond conversation, beyond words, beyond duality, beyond this and that. This is the opportunity we have in doing Zazen, and not just formally doing Zazen, but in our daily lives, getting free of the conversation in the mind, the thoughts, the din. Then the end of this paragraph. Catching, he suggests catching our desires as close to the center of our experience as possible. I think what we can understand is catching here. The word catching is noticing, catching ourselves in our desires. He goes on, practically, we can catch a need for an expensive new sports car early on in the process by buying a second-hand version of the same. We can catch it even earlier, nearer to the center, by renting one every now and again. Without having to go to at the expense of maintaining it, we can catch it very close in indeed by attempting to live out directly the very qualities that underlie the desire itself. And then he explains, without the prop of the car, we might try to cultivate a certain air of freedom as if the wind were always in our hair. The withdrawal from the literal, over-concretized periphery, where everything is counterfeiting for something closer in, almost always leaves us dealing in another, more imaginative currency at the center. Here, too, to experience even a moment of no thought, whether it's in the when we're sitting, or whether we're walking or driving or cooking or shoveling snow, just to have this experience of no thought is, I think, what he's referring to, as if the wind was always in our hair, a convertible. Now that our focus is shifting away from the peripheral bubble of promised riches, we are just beginning to be reminded again of the depths of poverty, both in the developing world and the United States, where the social safety net for those in difficulty has been worn almost to nothing. But it is exactly this reevaluation of the periphery and the renewed emphasis on what is essential that will bring spending back from mere baubles to infrastructure and education, back from foreign adventurism to a coherent approach to the sources of terror. And in the United States especially, there must be an attempt at a better healthcare system, a more cohesive, less poisonous political conversation, and a renewed relationship with a world in desperate need for it to return to its foundational ideals. This new faculty of evaluation can be quite disturbing to the way we might have priced and measured out our life in the recent unbalanced, heady times. The road of radical simplification almost always leads to the door of the great and unwanted unknown. The door, to begin with, seems to open on to nothing we at first can recognize. To enter through that door, we have to cultivate what Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind, where we stop having to know and name everything in advance and allow ourselves the satisfactions of discovery and revelation. Well, we don't have to lay this out as a strategy if we're doing Zazen regularly. It just happens. If we're doing serious Zazen, if we're doing more than 15 minutes a day, then we are going to notice this shift in perception and begin to notice what Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind, where we see things afresh. And then his last paragraph, learning, listening, and radically simplifying as we go, we might have a possibility of opening up that catalytic core where very few elements need combine to create a great deal of new energy. A decision made from this core has enormous leverage on the outer world where we see, hear, work, and have relationships. This internal center appears when the outer peripheries have bankrupted themselves, fallen, and become a loam that we must plow back to enrich the ground. In the depths of winter, under the cold night of wind and stars, and shut off from the garden, we look for those hidden and invisible springs that will uncoil in the still summer air each new, yet to be imagined rose. And all of this is at hand through Zazen, a life of the essential simplicity. No thought, or fewer thoughts. No thought is a rare privilege to reach a state of no thought, even momentarily. But fewer thoughts, having the clouds thin out at least, so we're not in this cocoon of noise, this internal noise that cuts us off from the environment, from others. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.